Well, hello, boys. Hey, Austin. Hey, Austin. I know. Well, you're awfully slow about getting a film made. Seriously.
Oh, it's only been 3 years.
I know. But, you know, God Committee, that took a lot out of you. Because that...
It certainly did.
That was such an intense film. A few months ago, I had somebody asking me about that film film again. That they they had just heard about it, and they went and they found what stuff I had written about it. And, you know, they said, well, where can we find it? I said, right now, I don't know. Google it and find out if it's streaming, if you can buy it. But they said, oh, it sounds interesting. I said, it is. But yeah, everyone, out of the blue, I get comments and inquiries from people about films, and God Committee was one of them that popped up recently.
Very cool. That's good to hear. Yeah, it took on a life of its own when it was on Netflix and became one of the top films on Netflix, and, you know, so many more people saw it at that point than they did originally, so it really started to snowball in such a good way. So it was very cool to see, and I still get people reaching out to me with emails and on social media, et cetera, talking about how much they loved it. So it's very cool to see a film take on a life of its own like that.
And, of course, that particular film, because of the very nature of it, and there was so much in the news recently about the woman that had the pig transplant, and she just passed away from it. So I think that sparks things in people, and they'll start checking things out and looking for it.
People were saying that was science fiction at that time, and it's really starting to happen right now with all of these gene editing companies trying to figure out that technology. It's really interesting.
Yep, that's exactly it. And, of course, this is also why you should not give up your DNA to any of these companies.
100%.
But, boy... You talk about changing the narrative after the God Committee. Coup, what a film to follow up with. Wow. Wow. And now Joseph gets to talk, too.
Do I have to?
No, if you don't want to, you don't have to.
No, I'm more than happy to.
Guys, I roared. I laughed my ass off watching this film. It is hilarious. It is dark. It is twisted. There's some whimsy in there. I love the socio-political commentary that you've got happening here on every level. Talking about vegans versus carnivores. Women relegated to just being in the home. The whole social classes. Servants and the wealthy. Feminism. Crime. You've got something happening for everything. And, of course, the reminder, you pick the great 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, which everybody should definitely be able to relate to in some capacity.
Yeah.
But you don't focus on the disease. You focus on the social situation at the time and how you have different people interpreting it and quote-unquote abusing it. This is so brilliant, guys. I love
it. Thank you so much, Debbie.
I love it.
I'm glad you liked it. Yeah, it's really interesting because we always envision the Spanish flu itself as just being the shipwreck that gets our characters marooned on a deserted island, and we never wanted to tell a film about the Spanish flu or specifically about COVID. Of course, there's the parallels And it's very interesting how a lot of the issues that they were dealing with during the Spanish flu were the same issues that we were dealing with during COVID. So we found that kind of fascinating. But other than that, we really wanted to tell a film about class struggle, a dark, twisted tale, as you alluded to. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Those are very kind words. We should probably steal a few of them for
feel free.
Future interviews.
Feel free.
The what if moment is what happens to this upstairs downstairs relationship when there is some sort of catastrophe outside and civilization stops functioning if only for a brief while. And we saw tons of comedic potential in that, but also as a reflection of the present. It's these broad scale emergencies have a way of showing the fault lines of the class system. So it was, we saw, you know, potential for a juicy story that could be loads of fun, and if you look for something additional, it's there for you, but it's not mandatory.
One of the big things for me that I thought was so great is you really skewer yellow journalism. The whole idea of what Jay does and the way he writes about things, and as his wife keenly points out, well, it sounds like you were really there, but you weren't there. And yellow journalism became so prevalent back in the day, obviously thanks to William Randolph Hearst. But that just leapt out at me, because that kind of subtextually tells us that, okay, we're in for a ride with this film, because that reveal comes so very early on in the film, within minutes. So that, I thought, was so crucial and so key, and you play with that and build on that. What is real? What is manufactured? All of these things, that these mores that they think they believe, and that Floyd is just knocking down with a chef's mallet at every turn. I love that. That is such a big element, and I wonder how many people are going to pick up on it.
About when we were writing it, and you know, this was in 2020, and in constructing Jay's character, is the journalist as activist. Like, what for us, Jay, at least at first, is somebody with tons of conviction that he's on the quote right side of history, and you know, where if he believes the ends are right, I mean, where at what point does any means, even those that might compromise his integrity, when is it justifiable and when is it not? And you know, as a window to the present, I think that's a lot of the spirit of a lot of journalists, is they really see themselves as guardians of the righteous.
I love how you introduced that. But now, once you had this great idea, and you put your little comedic minds to work and your twisted little minds to work, how did you go about developing these characters? Because these characters are extremely well-defined, particularly Peter and Billy's characters. And Peter just leaps off the screen. Leaps off the screen. He is so animated. He is snide. He's witty. He's sharp. He's a con man. And you can tell Peter really relished this role. So where do you start? You have this idea, and now you're fleshing out these incredible characters.
Well, this is where our personalities come into play. You know, Joseph and I have known each other since we were 6 years old. We've been friends forever, and we've been looking to work on something together for many years before we were able to sit down and do this. And it was because of COVID, because we had all the time in the world on our hands, that we just decided to finally sit down and do something together. And this is really a product of our sense of humor, of our, you know, twisted imaginations, etc. And just being in the room together and spitballing and coming up with things that made us laugh and elements of these characters that we connected with, and just brainstorming ideas and how to create really compelling characters is how this film was born.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mind meld of two very demented minds.
I will say that we were inspired by certain things that we were seeing at that time. For example, Chris Cuomo, you know, when he was at CNN, he was broadcasting from his basement in the Hamptons, mm-hmm. but he was implying that he was in New York City.
Yep.
And we found that hilarious. I mean, it was such a dark, you know, tragic time, and we just had to find some light somewhere, and there were certain, like, seeing that just felt so ridiculous to us, we felt like we had to build it in. And I think during the first, you know, I guess 2 months while we were concepting this, we had it taking place in the present day, and then it occurred to us, Spanish flu because I think one of us read an article about the similarities between COVID and the Spanish flu.
Mm-hmm.
And once we started to imagine all of the beats of the story set during that time, it started working on a whole different plane. Like, there's something about setting the film during that time that allows the themes to resonate on a whole different level, and that really helped us and allowed the film to take off in many ways.
Yeah, there was something uncanny in just seeing how little has changed, despite the popular imagination thinking, you know, everything is changing so much all of the time. I think there's almost a dark sense of humor in that very idea that, you know, try as you may, you know, history is repeating herself or rhyming with a, you know, with a little smirk. There's something just inherently futile about that sentiment that I think is darkly comedic.
As you shifted from a contemporary to back in 1918, did you start wondering how you were going to visually translate this as a period piece?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that with independent filmmaking becomes a budgetary consideration and what you can pull off and whether you can pull off the type of film that you want to make for that. But I think visually speaking, it's so much more interesting. And I do think that we pulled it off. We worked with a great cinematographer named Connor Murphy, young, super talented guy. And I think the film is so much better for it, just to be able to dive into that time period and photograph it, is for a filmmaker is a really compelling, you know, it's a compelling journey.
Well, and one of the great things here are the locations that you found, your exteriors and your interiors, and then Connor's lighting and lensing, especially inside, is just spectacular, and we really are immersed in that time period. And then that extends into the Stacy Jansen's costume design and your production designer, who obviously had to add something to those interiors. But how did you find the locations? Because without these locations for the Horton estate, this would not be the film it is.
Yeah, I mean, we shot it in New Jersey, and as I'm sure you know, all of New Jersey looks exactly like that.
Of course it does.
But those are actual. So there are really three mansions. There's the exterior, the one we use for the exterior, one we use for the interior, and then there's the pool. And those are all Gilded Age mansions, each with various storied histories. And we did a lot of location scouting that first started online and then in person. And yeah, I mean, when we saw it, we knew instantly that this is our mansion. And so the interior has a lot of the preserved furniture from the period. And you know, they let us astonishingly just shoot and, you know, go in full crewed up and go wild in that space. So, but
and augmented
and augmented exactly.
Yeah. But we were fortunate to find those locations, and there was the other part of that was, since we were using three different mansions to piece together the Horton estate, there was the consideration of how would it all fit, and you know, storyboarding was so important for this because of that.
I'm going to ask you about storyboarding versus shot listing, especially because the framing, Connor's framing, with so many of the interiors in particular. And the pool scenes, you make great use of doors as framing, and also because of that beautiful Olympic-style pool and the length of it, everything is, it's so framed perfectly with those shots of people diving in, naked or not, and either dangling in the pool, swimming the length of the pool, but it adds so much visual texture with the framing and the fact the lighting, it really, with the pool scenes in particular, the blue from the bottom of the pool and the water really stands out. So there's very minimal lighting around it. Whereas in the rest of the house, as large as it is and as high as the ceilings are, you really pull back and create a familial intimacy. And I found that really interesting in the visual design, in the visual grammar. Was that a conscious decision?
We picked up on that, and we're looking at the film and with that lens.
Yeah, I mean, I love the intimacy that you bring and the lighting, such as when Mrs. Horton, she comes in and sits down to play poker with the staff. And it's very low-key, intimate lighting. When people are eating, you've got light filtering in from windows, but it's very natural.
We're going for a natural lighting with a sort of elegant, heightened flair to it, if that makes sense.
Yes.
That we're working towards what we're trying to establish within the scenes emotionally.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that then gets, a little bit here of school at the end when, sort of anarchy breaks loose. I mean, we tried to underscore this idea of these very tight separation between the staff and the family, and the family is a unit. The staff is a unit that's, at first in their own separate house, and then almost the invasion of the staff into the family unit with the expulsion of Jay, and to translate that into into visuals and patterns of life.
Yeah, you've got great intimacy developing between the children and the wife and the staff. You've got Jay, who's now an outsider. But I love how we see that process take place through the lens of the camera, through the distancing. And it really starts taking shape with that shot from the second story down on the ground at night as the staff is now walking to the main house to live. And after that, your visual grammar, it just shifts. I love how you did that.
Much more controlled in the first act with the camera. All the movements were much more controlled, and we shot everything a bit wider. And then as the film progresses, things start to feel a bit more off kilter. And we lean into, even at times later in the film, there's a few scenes that are shot handheld as well to enhance, the savagery, taking over, the civilization fading away.
How challenging was the edit on this one? Because the comedy, it isn't balls to the wall comedy. It's dry, it's wry. Some of it, Billy Magnuson, he does some great comedic stylings, physical comedic stylings. But for the most part, you've got Sarsgaard, and it's his wry wit and snarkiness that really comes through. But it's hard to balance that as to what is too much, what is not enough. Especially when you're balancing it with what Sarah brings to the table, with a gentility that is a false gentility, almost, as we learn more about her. So how challenging was finding the balance and pace within the editing?
It's finding the right tone was a challenge from the script to the production and, up through the editing. Because it's not a conventional genre movie. As you said, it's not set up, punch. At certain times, you're even unaware of where to laugh. And if you're laughing at suspenseful moments or feeling suspense at otherwise comedic moments, and in the edit, it's not only just finding that moment within the scene, but it's also, does this work with everything else? So I think once we had a solid footing and we knew what was cool and what was not cool, and this goes for the script writing and the production itself as well as the edit, once we found that ground, everything else kind of became easier to work off of, because we could see this is this tone, or this is not that tone.
Yeah, he's alluding to, we'd have this phrase, does this feel like coup or does it not feel like coup? And we would constantly have that debate throughout the entire process. And we certainly put, we experimented with pushing the film more into comedic territory and more into thriller territory, and there was always just a balance that we needed to find with every scene, and we needed to be able to convey that to the actors and to our department heads as well, in order for that vision to just to be coherent.
And now that begs the question for you, Austin, coming off of the God Committee, which is not funny by any stretch of the imagination. You know, was this kind of an editing learning curve for you, sitting with your editors, to find this tone, this coup tone?
Well, thankfully, we worked with a couple really talented editors. Actually, one of the editors, Alan Kanant, he was the editor on the God Committee, so we mm-hmm. have a shorthand from that. And then we worked with Harrison Atkins, who's a young up-and-coming editor who had just done Emily the Criminal.
Yep.
You know, with both of them, there was a lot of trust put into them, you know, put into their work and seeing where they would take it and how they would interpret the footage that we shot, and a lot of discussions about, you know, whether to be pushing the film, you know, into broader comedy or reeling it back in, et cetera. And so it was challenging, but it was also really refreshing for me coming off the God Committee to do something like this.
I would think so, Austin. I would think so.
I had enough darkness. I mean, this is dark in a whole different way, but it's really, the God Committee's super heavy, and
yeah.
it was a lot of fun to be able to work on, you know, a film like this that's a comedy at heart.
So, now, Joseph, this is your first directorial experience, is it not?
It is.
So, how did you guys, number one, Joseph, were you crazy when you agreed to co-direct this?
Yeah, certainly.
I was going to say, why anybody would want to do it, I have no clue.
I still don't have any good answer to that.
Let alone with their BFF from elementary school age.
You're asking for a disaster from this. Maybe it's a masochistic streak, an unconscious masochism.
Maybe. Maybe.
I don't know. I mean...
But how did the two of you go about divvying up? Was somebody working with the actors? Was somebody primarily involved with the technical aspects? How did the two of you cohese for this co-venture?
There was no assignment of actors or tech. We saw the tone clearly enough together in the script stage where we had confidence that, you know, whatever, whenever somebody, one of us, is really, really has high conviction about something, the other person, interestingly enough, didn't feel that strongly about whatever that specific thing was. So since we're two separate human beings, obviously we disagree. But it was always that one of ours' passion in whatever the subject of the disagreement was so much more intense that the other one is like, oh, just let him have it, you know.
Well, Austin, you know, you're used to directing solo. Was it hard to relinquish some control here?
No, not at all. I enjoy that, actually. It's fun to collaborate with somebody. I mean, filmmaking is such a lonely process in the first place, being a director. And I know Joey as well as I know anybody. And so it was, I found it to be kind of exhilarating. And in a lot of ways, it's just less lonely. And I think ultimately this film is a reflection of both of our personalities. Like, if I went out and made a film without Joseph, it would be very different. And if he went out and made a film without me, it'd be totally different as well. And so it's cool to see this thing being born that is both of us.
You also have the added liberty of being able to blame the other guy when something goes wrong.
Yes.
We had plausible deniability.
How could I not think of that perk of having a co-director? Wow. Now, I've got to ask you guys, you've got some beautiful night shoots here. Were you shooting night for night? And also, were you shooting on any of these properties And because I think, aren't they protected under the National Historic Register? So, were you allowed to have bonfires?
Well, that was at Blair's Inn, which is actually privately owned. And so, as long as we had fire safety on set, we were okay to shoot that bonfire. And to answer your other question, it was all night for night.
Beautiful.
Which is great. It makes the film look a lot better.
And it does. And that's one of the great things, because your saturation, your polish, it looks beautiful. The whole film. But those night scenes really, really shine. I love the size of the fire.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite looking scenes is that bonfire when the family is putting on that play. It really is a beautiful scene. And that was shot handheld as well.
Which
I think it makes it stand out because very few scenes in the film were shot handheld.
To your question, though, we actually did want to make that bonfire even larger, and there was some issue with the fire department or something.
Yeah, it was the fire department. It wasn't historical property, though.
No.
There's lots of trees in New Jersey, and they're the kind that go up in flame very quickly, so I can understand that. Another fun element. You've got polish, you've got fun. At every level here, guys. You went with Nathan Halpern for the score. Nathan, who also, he scored Emily the Criminal.
Yep.
And, of course, I also just saw what he did with Blackwater Lane, and I had seen his prior work with the Martha Mitchell effect and Plan C. So I think you made a brilliant choice with Nathan, and having just seen what he did with Blackwater Lane, which is heavier and darker, the whimsy that he captures here and brings to Coup, it is a delight. There are light moments. You have the musical notes stay away from anything egregiously overbearing. What were your conversations with Nathan like for what you wanted musically to punctuate this film?
Well, as you picked up on, whimsy is certainly an element that we were going for to highlight the comedic aspects of the film, but there's also a lot of tension that runs through the film as well. So the question was, how do we marry those two things together into a score that feels completely cohesive? So if you're listening to a piece that's highlighting a comedic moment, it feels very much of the same score as a piece that's working with a more tense moment. And that was the conversation we had from the very beginning. And it's super challenging for a composer to be able to achieve that. And he really nailed it. He's a very talented guy, and we're lucky to have worked with him.
I mean, I love Nathan's work. I think you made the perfect choice in bringing him on for Coup, because his tone, it mirrors the tone of the film, tone of the dialogue, tone of the editing. Guys, you've done such a great job here. Everything is married together so well. Particularly with you, Austin, I love the growth I see in you as a filmmaker. Because I've seen The Runner, seen The Runner, as you know, The God Committee, as you well know. But to see you venture into this territory with a very distinctive period piece, but also this dark, twisted, comedic tone to it, that brings its own challenges to a filmmaker, and I think you have met them all, and I love seeing that growth in you as a storyteller.
Well, that's very cool to hear. Thank you, Debbie.
Joseph, God, you know, haven't seen any development in you yet. I sure as hell hope I do.
Joseph and I are planning to make many more films together, so I think this is the beginning of a long-term collaboration, and we're really excited to be working together.
So before you jump into your next venture together, let me ask Joseph, as a first-time filmmaker and working with Austin, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker?
I get the existential question.
You get the Austin will get the existential question too, as he knows, but you get it first.
I think the thing I'm making these things, I mean, as I now know, is extraordinarily stressful because there are just the limitations of time and budget, and you're, you know, just meeting your days is really half the battle. So it's, you know, rarely are you thrown into an experience where you actually need to problem solve on multiple dimensions in real time on a nonstop basis. So, you know, it was nice to know that I didn't totally fall to pieces under that situation. I only half fell to pieces, so it didn't knock me out entirely. So I can fight another fight.
Oh my God! So Austin, with this one now, which is totally different than what you've done before, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, in making Coup that's now going to impact your future work?
I feel like what I learned is, you know, and this is something that I'll continue to work on, is to try to block out all the noise that's going around you about money and about meeting your days, as Joseph alluded to, about people's problems on set, and remember that you're making a film, and remember never to compromise. Like, that whatever you're shooting that day is going to show up on the screen at the end, and you need to get it right, and you need to do it in a way that you feel really comfortable with and that you think is going to be incredible. Because you can't, you know, there's people chirping in your ear all the time, there's all these problems, and as a director, in order to really be great, you have to be able to tune that stuff out and remember that this is art that you're making, and just constantly, you know, I would just constantly repeat that to myself. So that's really what I've learned and what I'll, you know, take with me into the next film.
Well, you guys did a great job on Coup. I am so in love with it. I will definitely be watching it again. It's hitting theaters, is it not?
Yeah, it's in theaters August 2nd. It's getting a pretty wide theatrical release, so, and exclusively in theaters for a month, which is pretty rare these days. So we're very excited about that.
And I love this film so much, I am actually going to pay money and go to the theater and see it.
Thank you so much.
Of course, I will be using my senior citizen discount for the ticket, as I'm sure that Floyd would expect me to do.
Of course he would.
I think he would expect you to sneak in or something.
No, I stopped doing that when I was in high school. So I couldn't sneak anymore. Guys, this has been so much fun getting to talk to you about this film. I can't wait to see what you do together for a next film. Your sensibilities obviously play off of each other and just are so synergistic and meld so beautifully that if you can come up with this, I want to see you take it to the next level.
But we're actively trying.
Well, try a little harder, Joseph.
Yeah, we're already in the midst of a new script and pulling our hair out as we speak. So, but yeah, this was so much fun. Thank you for having us on.
Oh, God. Guys, thank you. You go have a rest of your day, and fingers crossed for a great opening next week.
Thanks, Debbie. Have a good one.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.